I am not very interested in the total amount of reach that podcasts have anymore. We know that lots of people listen to podcasts. That's fine. That's now a given. I am much more interested in time spent listening, because time spent listening is the thing that makes money. And if we can double time spent listening, even if we don't double anything else, we double the amount of money coming into our industry.
Did you get
my computer? Yeah.
How many?
Four.
Same.
I was quite annoyed. It was almost three. It was one letter.
Well, ladies, gentlemen, everybody, we are talking about Wordle because that is germane to the topic of today's episode. But before that, we are Media Voices. We take a weekly look at everything to do with the media, from the business side all the way through to the journalistic side of it as well. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that clip you just heard is from my interview with James Cridland, who is the Pod News editor and self-described radio futurologist. So Pod News is a daily email newsletter about everything podcasting, and it is honestly one of the smartest setups I've seen in terms of supporter structures, monetization, and automations. So James and I had a great chat about how he's found the sweet spot between his technical, editorial, and audio skills, why classifieds were a surprising success story for him, and the balance between newsletter growth and revenue. It's always tempted me to start coding, because I think if I could code, we would solve a lot of our problems.
I was thinking about coding in terms of this as well, in terms of this episode, because I was thinking about, could we basically launch our own Media Voices crossword app? But this is the last episode of the entire season, if you can believe it. We're taking a break to put the finishing touches on the Publisher Podcast and Newsletter Summits. The agendas, or at least some of the agendas, are available on publisherpodcast.com now. And you can get your early bird tickets until the end of this week. Once again, that is publisherpodcasts.com.
Da-da-da-da.
But as you might have guessed from that intro, we are going to be talking about The Guardian's new food app. So Esther, why did you include this in the newsletter, and why did it catch your interest so much? Because to me, this seems like it's a long overdue extension of the Guardian strategy.
The answer to number one is because I love apps and I hated everything else in Pocket this week. the second, I just think this really caught me off guard this week, because I was on newsletter duty when this story came out that the Guardian are launching the Feast app. It's going to be $2.99 a month, and it's a sort of recipe app from the Guardian's food writers. Great, that's all fairly straightforward. Me being a smart ass, I thought, oh, I wonder if they're going to launch a puzzles app too. Oh, look, they're being like the New York Times. Friday morning, barrage of emails in my book. Esther, they've had a puzzles app for ages. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so the timing on that's interesting, isn't it? Because they're not going to have a puzzles app for very long.
When I then looked it up, they're actually closing their standalone puzzles app at the end of this month. Like that, they've been running it for almost a decade now. And there's quite a lot of people that are quite cross about it, because they're rolling the puzzles functionality into their main Guardian Live app. Just for context, if anybody doesn't know, The Guardian is completely free to read, but their app is metered, and then there's a subscription starting about £10 a month, which makes sense. You know, you've got the web experience that's free, but if you want the sort of premium app experience, you pay for it. But it's this complete contradiction. If you launch this Feast app for the incremental revenue, you've got incremental revenue going on the Puzzles app, and you then roll that back in. So I don't really know. Is this separate teams dealing with this, or is there some? Am I missing something strategically here?
Well, I suppose that the idea with apps like this, and you know, the MIT for years has had both crosswords. You know, it's got a puzzles app specifically, which is separate. It's got a cooking app. It's got a parenting app. But they describe it as kind of an on-ramp to their news content. Now, they do exist separately, but the idea is to bring it into the wider MIT ecosystem.
I don't know enough about the Guardian's puzzle app, but. From a pure business point of view, if it was good enough to get people to pay for it, they would have tried to get people to pay for it, right?
It was a paid puzzle app, but it's...
Clearly there wasn't enough people paying, right?
But yeah. I thought if you've got an app like that, is it a case that maybe the timing of it wasn't quite right? Because now everybody's like after these puzzle apps.
Yeah,
there was a Reddit thread where this was closing. And people were like, well, where do we go now? Because the Times has got a puzzle app. But there are a couple of people like, well, we don't really want to line Murdoch's pockets any more than we have to. And the general feeling was like there's not really anything else in the UK, any publishers really doing smart things with that. And if the Guardian are then rolling it back, where else are you going to go? But overseas, you know, I mean, the New York Times is obviously the flagship leader, but there are a lot of publishers looking at the New York Times and doing exactly what they're doing and really investing in their puzzles and those daily habit builders. So to me, it this seems like the wrong time to be closing this.
This doesn't answer any of your questions.
No, I know.
However, we should get someone from Puzzler to come on the podcast next season and talk about this. Because they, you know, they sell, they license and sell puzzle apps to all sorts of people. So they've got a view, right? I was like, shit, it's a
I can't do it. I don't have the patience for that. You know, interesting.
Stupid Sudoku.
Ah, there's a Terry Pratchett book called Making Money, and the patrician in that, the kind of the leader of the city, does a Sudoku pastiche, and it translates directly to waste of time. I can't remember what it's called, but it's perfect. So
that's true of all puzzles, already.
But it's not time spent. Time you enjoy wasting isn't wasted time.
Oof.
And that, I think, is where. So, for instance, there's a really great stat in this article that we're going to link to from The Aftermath, which says that NYT subscribers now spend more time playing games than they do reading the news, which
humanity is just so
Well, I was going to say, is that good or is that bad? Because it's not like they're within the app. It's effectively paying for the NYT to do journalism. So it's not like it's completely without benefit.
If no one's reading it.
But no, it's not that nobody's reading it. It's that more people are spending time on the crosswords. And there's a really great quote in that Aftermath piece from Mike Hume, who's the former editor of Emerging Products at the Washington Post, who told Aftermath, "You can't predict the news. Some days it's crazy. Some days it's completely a snooze fest. But you're always going to have a crossword puzzle to play. In that way, you have these elements that are really good about building daily habits. So provided you're getting people back into the ecosystem of your brand, potentially it doesn't matter that people are spending more time playing your crosswords than they are reading your news."
It's just attention economy, surveillance economy, just bullshit. As long as we've got the eyeballs, we're winning, and it doesn't matter what we've got the eyeballs on.
Well, can I play devil's avocado here? You're always harping on about, you know, the good old days of publishing. Surely this was also the case when people were, you know, the free sheets were putting out their papers. People would pick those up, I'm going to say, to spend time with the crossword. More than they would the news on the tube.
Yeah, probably that is true, but it was all in the same package, right? I play Wordle every single day with my darling mother. it's a puzzle equivalent of three rings. Let me know you're okay. Oh, she's done Wordle this morning.
That's a great litmus test. Esther, do you know what the three rings was?
No.
Dear.
For the curious,
so basically, so you didn't have to pay for the phone call, when you got home you would ring three times and then hang up, and that was a signal that you'd made it home safe.
Okay. Genius. Yeah.
So I'm feeling very early 30s now.
When I get my little WhatsApp message every morning with the little Wordle squares on it that she's done Wordle, and I can then use, because I know what word she always starts on, I can use that to cheat and get a better score. When that comes through every morning, I know she's fine and all's good with the world. So people are paying a separate fee for this, and they might, the NYT can call it the on-ramp for its news, but we all know that's bollocks, right? And I think the Guardian, you know, having a food app is a great idea, but it's a food app, right? It's just like BBC Good Food's food app. You go on there, you find the recipes you want, you cook them, and then you piss off and you don't look at anything else that's going on with the Guardian. I'm not saying it's a bad business model. I'm just saying it's not a journalism based business model.
Well, but I don't think it's trying to be. In the same way that, you know, including classifieds in the back of an old school newspaper was not, you know, people consuming that wasn't, you know, benefiting journalists directly. It's kind of indirect revenue through these sources, which then goes back into it. I see this. Oh, God, I feel like I'm taking on your perspective here, Peter. I feel like this is just a recreation of an old method of funding the news.
There's something weird about this. It's like, oh, this will get more people reading our news content. But like bollocks.
Mm. Well, I can see that point. Hey, Esther, do you remember at the start of the episode when he said he wasn't going to have much to say about it?
I know.
Well, I've always got something to say.
All right. Well, Esther, what I suppose in this aftermath piece, there's that really good point that there isn't news all the time. And so it's good to kind of keep people around, even if it's with non-news content. For the Guardian's Feast app, obviously it's got that initial £2.99 a month price point. Why is the Guardian well known enough for food content for that to entice people across from the other pre-existing cooking apps? Because to me, that £2.99 seems like a big barrier to entry almost.
Really? I thought it was a small barrier to entry.
But I think it's the hassle gap of it as well. I mean, I know that there's probably a tertiary benefit here if he's about to go off one.
Well, it's like classic millennial thing of just spending all your money on avocado toast and food apps. Oh, that's the point.
No, I think,
well,
I think if
once
you
bought the avocados, you need the food app to learn what to do with them.
If you look at some of the equivalents on the market, you know, BBC Good Food have got a paid food app. It's a similar sort of price point. And I think if you're on the app store and you're looking for food apps, and you see The Guardian, it's a brand you trust, even if you don't necessarily know that they're great for cooking. I mean, there's some weird stuff on the App Store. So, you know, you're probably going to go type the BBC Good Food or The Guardian or another brand like that. I'm a bit torn on this whole adjacent issue because I feel like you're not going to buy The Guardian's food app and then decide to convert to a new subscription or supporter subscription. But on the other hand, like, why do we always have to take ourselves so seriously? Like, journalism doesn't have to be very serious, long reads for us to pay for it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm really, really on the fence about it.
I'm really surprised by this. I would have thought that the only criticism we would have of this is the fact that it's late in the kind of the life cycle of something like this.
Not in the UK.
What everyone is talking about is engagement and community building, audience retention, all these things. And you can't retain or grow an audience just by supplying one kind of content. It just doesn't work that way. Not if you're a newspaper. If you're Tractor Monthly, yeah, great, one type of content. So I suppose in terms of an audience engagement, audience retention strategy, it's brilliant. Where I get, I suppose, hung up on all of this is the payment models around it become really complicated if you're a reader. If I just paid The Guardian a tenner a month and I got everything, I can kind of get my head around that. But if I'm paying The Guardian a tenner a month to read news, and then I'm paying them £2 a month or £3 a month to get my recipes. I don't know. It's just, I get, again, from a business model point of view, it's that share a customer.
Mm.
But in a world where we're paying for subscriptions for everything, from Netflix to shaving gear to, I don't know, getting our Teslas fixed.
Well, did you see that massive recall of the Cybertruck? Every single one has had to go back because the accelerator kept getting stuck. Brilliant. Mwah. But
poor Elmo.
I know. I see what you mean, but surely this is a... Yeah, but it's a question. Is it not a question of targeting and messaging? They, because of propensity data, will know who can potentially, you know, they can sell on just this just this cooking app versus the people who will pay for, I don't know. I don't even know if they offer a package which has everything in it yet, but surely that's...
Their pricing is quite confusing. We did try to look it up before this episode, and it's all over the place. Like if you pay The Guardian £20 a month, actually, it's not clear what you get. And I suppose they've got that kind of supporter model, and then they've got this. So they've got a Guardian Live News app, which is a separate subscription, but you can get that if you pay enough money as a supporter. It's not clear at all. If anybody from The Guardian's listening, can you please sort your messaging out around this?
That's a messaging issue.
And I suppose that's the point I'm making about... how this is different from the good old days, which were the bad old days. You bought the paper and that was it. You had everything. You didn't have to go through this weird Krypton factor process to try and figure out how much you're actually spending every month. And that's not The Guardian. That's not having a go at The Guardian. That's every subscription-based entertainment and news product.
One thing I will say, though, and I'm going to tactically ignore the puzzles issue here because I've already looked enough of Wally about that, is that my Nieman Lab prediction from last year about publishers slicing off things that they could get smaller, like smaller entry level subscriptions to. This is an example.
Yeah,
I'm right on one
100%
thing.
100%. In fact, yeah. Well, just before we finish, then I would like to pitch a couple of ideas, because obviously the whole idea with these apps is that they are sticky. They bring people within the ecosystem, and you know you can monetize different levels of people.
Phrase.
I'm afraid that that's the phrase.
Sticky food app. Ooh.
Oh. Like honey mustard chicken stuff. Nice. But I think there is a great case to be made for Tamagotchis to come back as news-related apps. So you have the NY Tamagotchi, you've got the Times-a-gotchi and Sunday Times-a-gotchi. Just that would keep people coming back, because they've got to feed the beast every couple of hours, and therefore they're still within the ecosystem. Genius.
That makes more sense than some of that stuff. You know, at least it's blatantly habit-driven, right?
Oh, like a cow clicker.
You know what? We could do a Media Voices Tamagotchi with a little Peter, that if you don't feed him, he just hurls insults at you.
Yeah.
Yay!
Calls you a bean counter.
We could have a huge recording session where I just record every insult that I can think of.
Well, I mean, this is the 284th episode. I'm sure that somewhere in the archive you have said every single insult under the sun.
So oh, no, I've just got plenty more of his sleep.
There's a couple. Have you said ball bag?
Ball bags. Absolute ball bags.
And don't forget that if you are interested in everything to do with the business of media and potentially some Tamagotchi chat as well, you can come along to the Publisher Newsletter and Publisher Podcast Summits. And you can get your tickets for that. There is still an early bird rate available until the end of this week by going to publisherpodcast.com.
This week I spoke to James Cridland, editor of Pod News. I've been a huge Pod News fan since discovering it back in 2019, so I love doing a deep dive into the business models and workflows behind running an industry-leading daily newsletter as a solo entrepreneur. So I started by asking James what opportunity he spotted to launch the newsletter back in 2017.
Yes, I mean, I would love to claim it was my idea. It wasn't my idea. It was the idea of a friend of mine who we were both at a radio conference in Los Angeles. I think it was called the International Radio, the Worldwide Radio Summit. That's right. And I think I was the worldwide bit. It was as worldwide as the worldwide series of baseball seems to be. But anyway, in the pub afterwards, I was chatting to a friend of mine, and he said, "Where do you get your information about podcasting?" And he was involved in the podcasting world. And I said, "Well, that's a really interesting question. I haven't really thought of that. Yes, I'm not sure that there is anywhere really, apart from Hot Pod at the time, but Hot Pod was very focused on a particular area." And so I thought, when I came back to Australia, I thought, "Oh, well, maybe that's a thing that I could do." And so spent about a month or so thinking about how to do it, and ended up launching it in late May of 2017. So I've been doing it every single day ever since, which has been quite a thing.
What made you decide to go with a newsletter rather than, say, launching a podcast about podcasts, which you now have?
So I'll tell you why I launched a podcast, first of all, because that's probably a little bit more of a strange conversation. I launched a podcast because it turns out I'm all about workflow, as I'll probably talk ad nauseam about in a little bit. But one of the bits of workflow of writing a newsletter is to read it out aloud before you send it, as you would do with an important email, as you would do with everything else, because for some reason the human brain spots more errors and more typing problems and phrasing problems if you read it out loud. And I realized that I was reading it out loud, and I thought, I used to be in radio. I can probably do this for a living. And so thought, I'll just record myself reading it out loud. So that's all. That's the reason why the podcast exists. But I went for a newsletter really because I saw I'd had a lot of experience in doing an online publication. I was doing a weekly newsletter, which I still write, actually, which is all about international radio trends and what's happening in the radio world. And I thought, well, I know how to do that. And I also, I think, know how to make that into a business. And so whereas, you know, podcasting is harder to sell advertising around in comparison to sponsored sections in a podcast, for example, sponsored sections in a newsletter, for example. So I thought, right, I can make this into a business easier if I make it into a newsletter. So that's what I ended up doing.
I'll get onto the business bit in a minute, but I'd love to get into this workflows thing, because Pod News for me is one of, in fact, I think it's the best newsletter I've come across in terms of, you'll talk about workflows, but it's very well thought out technically. We've done some ads and things with them before, but you can almost book an ad and get slots in that newsletter without ever having to speak to you.
Correct.
Was that set up like that from the start, or have you sort of evolved the workflows as it's gone along? And I'd like, if you could just talk me through how that works sort of technically. So you've got all this Patreon integration, and it's very clever.
Well, yes. I mean, I started by thinking, what is the quickest way that I can produce a daily podcast newsletter? What's the simplest way that I could do that? Because I do an awful lot of speaking overseas. I do an awful lot of travel. You know, my theory at the time was that I would be having a full-time day job working for, you know, some radio station that might hire me during the day. And so my theory was, I need to be able to write something in the evening when I know that I've got the spare time. So the fact that Pod News comes out at 6 o'clock in the morning, New York time, is a happy accident of the fact that I'm in Brisbane in Australia, and 6 o'clock in the morning is 9 o'clock at night, my time. So I could do that very simply and very easily. So that was, you know, that was certainly helpful. So again, the time that it comes out is to do with the workflow of making it fit in with the rest of the things that I was planning on doing during the day. The format that it is in is to do with the workflow, because what I didn't want to do is to rewrite a press release and make every single news story its own web page, because madness lies there. So I've run enough websites that I know that that's not really a sustainable thing. So, you know, the whole point of it is that it's very short. So the whole thing really is around the workflow, is around making it as easy and quick for me to do as possible, so that I can do other things during that working day, you know, as I want to, but also so that I can focus on the creative side rather than the button pushing side. Because the creative side, the thinking up of stories to write, the reporting on those particular stories, that's much more creative. Whereas laying something out to appear in a newsletter is not a creative job at all, and is the sort of job that I didn't really want to end up doing. It's very much focused on creativity and trying to cut the amount of button pushing down to the bare minimum that I can possibly manage.
And have you coded a lot of that yourself? I've researched this, the vendor market for our own newsletter, and I found there's virtually nothing that does what I want it to do. So I'm assuming you've probably done a lot of that yourself in the back end.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm one of those people that codes websites. That's, you know.
Well, here's another business opportunity. Package that up and sell it. And there's a whole host of newsletters out
yes,
there.
Yes, quite a lot of people have told me to do that. And I did used to run other websites for other people, but that ends up being, and other newsletters for other people, but that ends up being so much more difficult and complicated. I really didn't want to end up doing that. So I have stopped doing all of that. But, you know, as it was up until a couple of months ago, actually, the Pod News website, the same code that produced the Pod News website was producing up to four different other newsletters using the same code. And you'd never know, because the whole, you know, all of those looked very different. But yes, and so I coded it specifically because, again, I wanted to make life really simple and really easy. So one example is, for example, at the bottom of the Pod News newsletter every day is a section which is called Podcasting News. And Podcasting News, when you look at it, is news about specific podcasts, and it's news which is specific around, you know, here's a podcast, here's something newsworthy about it. Maybe it's a launch, maybe it's a new season or whatever. And you can see there's a beautiful little thumbnail of the podcast. There's a link to a page which has more information on how you can listen. So firstly, that information is completely automatic. So I just type in, it's a podcast, it's this podcast, and my code goes off and goes, oh, he's linked to a podcast here. He must want it laid out in this way, with this thumbnail and in this format. So all of that's completely automatic. But it's also automatic in terms of it producing a podcast feed, which is called New Podcast Trailers, which is a podcast that you can get in you know, Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's a completely automated feed of new trailers for podcasts that you might want to go and have a listen to. So again, it's all of that completely automated stuff. And the classified section actually was quite funny in that I'd tried doing classifieds before in other, well, other newsletters that I was doing. And I knew that it didn't work. So I knew it was a complete waste of time. But I thought to myself, well, you know, nobody will buy these things, but I'd better code it. But I'm going to set myself a goal of spending one day coding this. I don't want to spend any longer. I just want to spend one day coding this particular tool. So the morning was spent coding, you know, customer accounts and how you would sign in and, you know, what would happen if you forgot your password. And right at the beginning, if you forgot your password, you were taken to a page saying, congratulations, you're the first person to forget your password. So put this thing together by the end of the day. And of course, by the end of my working day, you lot are still asleep. So that's fine. So by the end of my working day, I'd written something that vaguely worked. I put it live, went to bed, woke up the next morning to see that I had had one order already. And that order was for $500.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh, maybe I should, you know, apply a style sheet to it and make it look nice and sort out the forgotten your password links and all of that. So that was a real sort of wake up call of, oh, maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe this is something that I can actually offer. So the way that the revenue works now is it's essentially, and I'm in an incredibly lucky place, a third of my revenue comes from classified advertising. A third of my revenue comes from supporters on Patreon that will support what I do either as a company and you get a logo or as a, you know, personal supporter. And then the final third comes from sponsors and advertisers who are in the newsletter. And I have someone who helps me with sales for that, who's based in the US. And that's so, so helpful to have three very different revenue streams, which essentially allows me to report openly and honestly about individual companies, even if they're advertising with me, because I know that, you know, if they really don't like what I've written, then they will go away, but that won't mean the end of my company. Whereas I've worked for many people who have relied on one or two large advertisers or one or two large clients and found it very difficult. So, yes, I'm really lucky in that regard, in that I have a good spread of revenue from different types of sources.
Is that something you always had in mind from the outset, that you'd have those different streams? Or was it like the classifieds that you just sort of maybe thought you'd try a Patreon and try sponsored slots and just see how they went?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was trying things. I did write my own Patreon because, of course, I did.
Of course.
So I wrote my own Patreon, which I then put live. And the benefit at the time was that, you know, you didn't have to be billed in US dollars and all of that. And I realized the power of the brand at that point, because I suddenly realized, wow, no one is signing. I actually split it. So you could either sign up with the Pod News newsletter and do that automatically, or you could sign up with Patreon, and virtually everybody would press the Patreon button. And I thought, well, there you go. That shows the power of the brand, the power of actually being with a company that is trusted like Patreon to take money in this way. And so, so I closed my own version down. You really need to spread where you're getting revenue from to make sure that you can weather storms in terms of less sponsorship money or less supporters money or whatever it might be. So, that was a really important part for me. And the reason why classifieds exist is that the pricing model starts very, very cheaply. So it starts at $29. Per insertion. But the way that I priced it is it's priced in the same way as airline tickets. So the more that are sold, the higher it gets, so that I don't have a maximum amount of ads that I will accept. But clearly, you're not probably not going to buy the sixth or the seventh when it's $400 or $500 per insertion. That would be a little bit mad. So it's got that sort of, you know, balance in there as well.
And I'm guessing you've coded that as well.
And I'm afraid, yes, I coded that. That was it. That was in my one day of right. Coding. I was quite pleased with that.
It's what strikes me that part of what's made this so successful is that kind of that intersection of technical skills. So you're not relying on what vendors are providing on the market, and that sort of editorial, spotting that editorial opportunity, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very lucky in that I've done three things in the past. I have been a writer for commercials in commercial radio. So those annoying 30-second ads for double glazing, you know, I used to write those. And that taught me how to write quickly, first of all, but it also taught me word economy and, you know, how to get over something in as short amount of sentences as possible. Working in radio also meant that I got legal training because I was also behind a microphone. So I know what I can say and know what I can't say, which is kind of important too. So I've got that as part of my background, but I've also got as part of my background running a website and coding a website, you know, so that's an important thing too. And of course, you know, the interest in audio, the interest in working in the audio space, which I've done for over 30 years now. So I'm quite lucky that, you know, essentially when this came along, there was a real gap in the industry for news about the podcasting industry. And I was lucky enough to jump in with the three skills that have made it quite easy to do this as a one-man operation. And that's been quite helpful and quite handy.
I was one of the first sort of 5,000 subscribers, but it's now at about 30, I think it was 30,000 when I last checked. That's probably automated as well, that probably automatic update.
I'm afraid it is, yes. Why waste time doing that?
Exactly. I think if there's a single question I want to know, that the answer is somewhere on the Podnews website. Yeah. Do you sort of increase the amount you charge sponsors as that goes up, or do you not see the value as necessarily tied to the size of that email list?
That's a great question, Esther. And I think one of the difficulties that I've got is, well, I've got two problems. One of the problems is I've got 30,000 people getting my newsletter every single day. How many people are working in podcasting as a business? What is the universe? I don't know whether that's 35,000, in which case I'm pretty well there, and I've just annoyed the other 5,000, and that's fine. Or whether it's 3 million. I genuinely don't know what the answer is. So I've got that as one issue, that I don't frankly know what my addressable universe is. And on the other side, a lot of people say, you know, well, you should be advertising more, you should be getting your name out there, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm there going, if I was to double the amount of people getting the newsletter tomorrow, I couldn't necessarily double the amount of money that I was getting in from advertising, because there is a finite amount of what an advertiser will pay for a newsletter. And yes, I could put the prices up a little, but I don't think that I could double them with double the amount of users. So actually, it's a really interesting ROI conversation, and I don't know what the answer is. And I think I'm a little bit stuck in terms of, you can see other newsletters which are much more broad in scale. And you can see them clearly, if they double or treble the amount of people getting their newsletter, then they can get an awful lot more. I'm not sure that it works on my side. And so I've got that's one issue. And the other issue is, where do I advertise? Even if I was going to advertise, where do I advertise? So one of the things that's most important for me and that works as well as anything else is actually partnering with podcast events, podcast awards, partnering with those sorts of things. And I've run plenty of events in the past, so I understand what they want, to be able to help promote those events and in return maybe get a data share or maybe get some form of, you know, marketing for those events, because those are exactly the sort of people that I would like to be talking to. But as for advertising on Facebook or on Twitter, it's I've never found that to, you know, to work at all.
I mean, it's about quality as well, isn't it? You know, you could quite easily buy lists and quadruple the size of your list. And I think you maintain quite good open rates. Do you look to sort of clean the lists at all, or do you just let it sort of grow organically?
I don't think you can clean the lists, because I don't think you can reliably say whether or not somebody has opened an email. So we've got open rates of around 47%, which is a very high open rate for this sort of thing. But I don't want to get rid of people who, according to my system, hasn't opened their email, because, I mean, they might be using Apple Mail, and in which case I would never know. They might be using Gmail, and in which case they all look as if they're coming from Virginia. You know, I mean, I really don't know. And so from that point of view, I mean, obviously, every single email that I send costs me money. in terms of the per email cost that I pay Amazon. That money is tiny, but nevertheless, you know, that's a side of it as well that I need to bear in mind. You know, cleaning lists and things and monitoring. I mean, we talk in podcasting a lot about how our statistics are rubbish and how, you know, we've hardly got any numbers. Wake up to the world of newsletters. I mean, goodness me. You know, I mean, open rates. I've read something recently that says that 60% of email opens are actually robots. I'm not sure that I necessarily believe that number, but there's certainly an amount of robots who are both opening the email and clicking some of those links.
And click on every single link. When all the links down the bottom are clicked, I know that that's a bot.
The one thing that I do, and I'm very, very keen about doing it, is the whole double opt-in thing of somebody signs up. I then send them an email saying, hey, are you sure you want to sign up? Press this button to sign up. And they don't get the newsletter if they haven't gone through that additional step. That's a really important thing for me, and it saved my bacon in the last sort of 3 months or so, because PodNews has reached a size where spammers are very keen to go through my entire website and find any form that they possibly can and fill it with information about selling cannabis, which is lovely. But but of course, I've had to then put quite a lot of things in place to stop those robots and those scammers from going through every single thing, and that's been that's been quite a lot of pain to get that bit done.
And that means, you know, that those 30,000 people at some point have actually said, yes, I do want to opt into that, even if they don't necessarily continue opening.
Yes, absolutely. And we know, you know, I mean, I spot bounces every single day from people that, you know, aren't getting the email anymore. I think it's a 3 bounce and you're out rule. And to be honest, that's been one of the issues over the last year, has been the amount of redundancies in the podcast industry in the US. I mean, Spotify made 2,300 people redundant alone. The amount of those redundancies has actually had a real impact on the amount of people getting my newsletter, because all of a sudden you can see 2 months after that, you know, that happened, all of a sudden my numbers went down as Spotify's IT finally started cancelling all of those email addresses. So it was, you know, so that's been something that's hurt quite a bit as well.
I'm assuming you're probably making enough from those 3 revenue streams to keep yourself quite comfortable. I did notice you've made a little bit of an acquisition in the last 12 months.
Yes, I did. Yes. So I bought a competitor of mine, which was quite interesting. The website is called podcastbusinessjournal.com. It was actually put together by a very long-term friend of mine, Eric Rhodes, who does a number of radio magazines in the US as well. And there was an opportunity to acquire that particular business. So I did in May of last year. And that's been really helpful, because the number one reason why people unsubscribe from the PodNews newsletter is that it's daily. And now that's the point of it. It's a daily newsletter. And so that was quite difficult. I didn't really have a way of keeping those people, even if they didn't want a daily newsletter. I didn't have an easy way of keeping those people so that I could reach them. And so acquiring another brand was really helpful, because that enabled me to turn Podcast Business Journal, which was a competitor of mine, really, into a weekly focusing on business, because that's what it says on the tin, with a long form interview every single week. And if somebody unsubscribes from the PodNews newsletter, I can then turn around and say, if you were getting too much email, no worries, you can just get this instead. And there is a high degree of people going, oh, well, that's good. I don't want to be completely shut off from this world, but I just don't want emails every single day. So that's been super helpful. So yeah, that's been good. I wouldn't necessarily say that's been a profitable purchase, but it's been a very good defensive purchase, certainly. And certainly we've seen over the last year or so, we've seen other podcast newsletters falling by the wayside. Hot Pod only very recently going on inverted commas hiatus. But since they've refunded everybody, that's going to be a long hiatus, one would assume. But that probably gives a bit of pressure on me to write a bit more long form content and to focus not just on the, you know, lots of links to individual stories, but to also do a little bit more of the long form stuff that I enjoy doing. But it's, you know, it's obviously it's much harder to and more time consuming to do.
You mentioned HotPod. I think Ariel from HotPod signed off last week, and it was quite a curious editorial she wrote, where she sort of almost seemed to have the view that podcasting hadn't quite lived up to its promises. Do you think we're seeing an industry right-sizing, or is there still quite a lot of unmet potential that maybe the hype cycle just got a bit big?
I think we're seeing a US industry resizing, absolutely. And I think one of the things that I've tried to do with the Pod News newsletter is to tell a global story. You know, I'm a Brit, as you can tell from this excellent accent. I live in Australia. I've worked for companies in Canada, in the US, in mainland Europe. So hopefully I can bring something which is a little bit more European. And I think if I had a criticism of the original HotPod, is that it was very much focused on the North American market and, to be frank, the Brooklyn market. That's what it was really, really focused on. So broadening things out has, I think, been very helpful. And I do think that if you look at the story over the last year or so, we've seen that a lot of boom and bust in North America, particularly the US, as interest rates have risen, as there's no more free money, all of a sudden the stock market has been asking for profit. And I think that has been incredibly painful. But I've not seen that in Europe. I've not seen that in the UK. I've not seen that in other parts of Europe, where we've seen still an awful lot of M&A activity. Here in Australia, I've not seen that too. So I think that there's probably a tale of two industries at the moment. There's the US, which probably overheated, I think is fair to say. And there's the rest of the world, where slow and steady wins the race, where we appear to be still seeing nice increases, whatever Ofcom might be saying recently. I still think we're seeing increases in the amount of people who are tuning into podcasts, and the amount of revenue, the amount of advertising spend, which is going into podcasts as well. But I think from Ariel's point for North America, it's absolutely right. It's a very different, you know, it's a very different feeling industry now than it was 2 years ago. I have to say, podcast movement in Denver last year, a lot of people were basically sitting there as if they were deer stuck in the headlights. They had no idea what was going on. And it was very, very worrying for them. I think I got a sense when I was in LA earlier in the year, I got a sense that people are much more optimistic now in North America about where the industry is going and what the industry is actually doing. And I think that that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I still remember, I don't know if it was an Ofcom chart, but there was a chart with the time spent with podcasts and the ad spend with it. And there was just this enormous gap. And it's completely the other way around with a lot of platforms like social media. And yeah, it just sort of strikes me that there's been a lot of perceiving podcasts as, oh, you need to have, you know, millions of listeners and a huge reach in order to get any value. And it's actually, they're much more like events in the sense you can have a small number of very engaged people, and that's more valuable than millions of flyby listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wish, you know, and I keep on saying this to, you know, the folks at Edison and at other people, I am not very interested in the total amount of reach that podcasts have anymore. We know that lots of people listen to podcasts. That's fine. That's now a given. I am much more interested in time spent listening, because time spent listening is the thing that makes money. And if we can double time spent listening, even if we don't double anything else, we double the amount of money coming into our industry. And there really isn't the data out there that shows time spent listening, partially because it's much harder to calculate. But I would love to see more data on that.
I'm going to finish. I feel like every single interview these days, there's always an AI question, but you've had some stories in the newsletter about AI podcasts. Where do you see that impacting the industry? Is it all a lot of hype, or are we all going to be replaced by AI clones of ourselves?
Yeah, AI. So in my other life as a radio consultant, I am currently enjoying great success in a traveling presentation, which is new and interesting AI tools from the world of podcasting that you can be using in your radio station. And I'm really enjoying that. And probably the first thing that I start by saying is, you do know what AI stands for, don't you? It stands for artificial intern. It's not anything more than that. It's an additional helping hand. but you are most definitely going to want to check whatever your artificial intern does prior to putting it on air or making a podcast out of it or anything else. I find it interesting. So we've just had two large announcements this week about AI translations, of taking a show which has been very popular and translating it into a different language using AI and clone voices and blah, blah, blah. And I find it interesting that, firstly, they're always English shows, aren't they, being translated into other languages. And I'm kind of there thinking it's a bit colonial to basically go, the only things that really work are English language, and we're letting you, person that doesn't speak English, enjoy this wonderful show that we have made. And I've not seen the other way around, and I wish I could see more of the other way around. So that's the first sort of thing that just makes me slightly nervous about it. But I do think that, you know, to come back to what we were saying right at the beginning of this, getting rid of the drudgery that isn't creative and allowing you to just do more creativity, more self-sustaining creativity, because it's important that it pays your way and it's worth your while, then an artificial intern is really helpful in terms of that. So where AI, I think, really helps is Buzzsprout, which is a podcast host that I use for one of the shows that I do, will automatically run a transcript of the show, write a description of what we talk about in that particular show, write a title. It'll work out where the chapter points are if you want it to do that. It'll pull individual clips out so that you can tweet those or put those on Mastodon or whatever it is that you want to use these days. And I think that that use of AI is brilliant, is so, so useful, of just a way of just making things easier in terms of that regard if you don't have the time or the talent to end up doing that. So AI is brilliant for that. In terms of clone voices and in terms of writing full scripts for podcasts, I'm not so sure yet. But, you know, the slightly scary thing is AI right now is the worst it'll ever be. It'll only get better from here.
It will.
Only get better.
Our ethos is that, well, we're probably not as good as AI. So, you know, as long as we keep being authentically crap, we're irreplaceable.
But, you know, I mean, I think from a publisher's point of view, if you've got a podcast interview that you have produced, for example, then using AI to turn that into a transcript, using AI to then turn it into the basis of a blog post, just gets the most value out of the great content that you already have. Turn it into a magazine article. You can do a bunch of things like that that actually works an awful lot. We were talking about the Podcast Business Journal earlier. The Podcast Business Journal is literally me going through, it takes an hour every week, of me going through the Pod News newsletter, pulling out any business-related stories to do with the US, and then transcribing an interview that we've probably already done for the Pod News Weekly Review, which is our long-form show. So in terms of getting the very best out of your content, that's, I think, a really good example of where AI can jump in and can really help produce a different product which actually reaches different people, but is not just a random hallucination. It's just grabbing information that you've already used elsewhere.
So if people want to brave a daily podcast newsletter in their inbox, where can they find you?
So they can visit podnews.net and subscribe for free. You can also subscribe to the Podcast Business Journal as well, which is also free. And you'll find that at podcastbusinessjournal.com. And of course, there's a podcast version of everything, because of course there is. And you'll find the Pod News Daily wherever you get your podcasts.
So that's it from us for this season. We'll be back again September, maybe? Depending. Yeah,
sometime in the future.
Give or take. But in the meantime, keep an eye out for some conversations episodes, some media briefs episodes, summit teasers, some learnings, and much more. Particularly in our daily newsletter, which we tell you about all the time because it makes you the smartest person in the room and that kind of stuff. But until we come back again, you can keep in touch via the newsletter, via the community forum. We're still on X a little bit. X. It just makes me laugh.
How dare you, yeah.
But probably LinkedIn is better. Or just go to the website, voices.media, and you can find everything we do there.
I heard X described the other day as a neo-Nazi fascist hellhole. So you can find us there. At Media Voices Pod.
And don't forget, if you have a brilliant publisher newsletter, entries are open now for our publisher newsletter awards. You've got until early May to get them in. I think there's probably going to be an extension. You can get them in at publishernewsletters.com. And if you want to come to our newsletter and podcast summit on June the 12th, go to publisherpodcast.com for tickets, agenda, and everything else. We'll see you there.
We certainly will. But until then, thank you so much for listening to this season of Media Voices. Like Peter said, we will be back with more trenchant insight into the media industry in the near future. But for now, thank you so much and have a great summer.
Bye-bye.